Thursday, June 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump blames Attorney General Jeff Sessions for the Russia probe. Guatemala copes with a deadly volcano eruption, and Democratic presidential candidate Robert Kennedy was fatally shot 50 years ago, and we look back at his legacy. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump unleashed a new broadside against Attorney General Jeff Sessions on Tuesday, blaming him for the year-long investigation into Trump's 26 campaign links to Russia because he removed himself from oversight of the probe. Trump said on Twitter, "The Russian witch hunt hoax continues, all because Jeff Sessions didn't tell me he was going to recuse himself. I would have quickly picked someone else." More than a year ago, Sessions recused himself from oversight of what eventually became Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian meddling in the election and whether Trump obstructed justice by firing FBI Director James Comey when he was leading the probe. VOA's Lori London speaks with criminal defense attorney Jack Rice.
"This is the most aggressive approach I have ever seen from a sitting American president. This president and his team are claiming two things. First of all, that they can't force him, meaning Bob Mueller, can't force him to appear for a subpoena. And number two, he literally can't be indicted. He can't be charged with obstruction because he can pardon himself. They're literally making both of those arguments. This has never been supported in law. This has never been supported by the Supreme Court or any case law in the United States. And yet that's the argument that is being made. Essentially, what they are arguing is this, is that this president is above the law. He has the ability to control those people in law enforcement. He has the ability to hire them, or at least to move them forward. He has the ability to fire them for any and all reasons. Even if they're illegitimate ones, he has the right to do it. That's what Rudy Giuliani is trying to argue right now. But the problem is there is nothing in the law that says he has the right to do that. Because if you make the argument that he can do anything he wants when he wants, that means that he could bring on specific judges he wanted to have on the bench because they were criminal. He can't do that. He can't fire them because he's trying to hide an investigation, because there's no support for that anywhere in the law. And here's the weirdest part, and this is according to this letter from January. They were making an argument about a statute, which is actually the wrong statute. You have to go back and realize that the argument that they were making actually is old law. There's new law from 2002, a new statute that applies in this particular case, and they actually missed it. It's shoddy legal research, truly. And I mean it objectively.
What do you mean they missed? What did they miss?
What they missed is this. Mm-hmm. Is they make an argument about the standard and at which they can apply and say that they have the right to, this president has a right to fire anybody for any reason, even a bad one, even an illegal one.
Even if it's about someone who's investigating him.
Even if somebody finds out that he was involved in criminal activity, he has the right to fire him.
And then he's not can't be held accountable?
Exactly. That is actually the argument. Problem is you go back to a new law that was actually passed into law by Congress in 2002, mm-hmm, that says very specifically, you can't do things for the wrong reason. The problem is that the president's team from January, really tied back to June of 2017, addresses it in the wrong way, the wrong law, the wrong statute, and misses the fact that the law was actually changed in 2002. But even that runs a little too far into the weeds, because regardless, what we find is that this president actually can be subpoenaed. The president can be subpoenaed in the very way that Bill Clinton was subpoenaed. Let's think of it like this. Bill Clinton was subpoenaed because of behavior he was involved in before he became president. The investigation in this particular case could apply to a subpoena involving what this president was doing when he was running for the presidency. To make the argument you can't force him simply ignores the reality of the law that was driven by the Republicans, by Ken Starr, and specifically would apply under relatively similar circumstances and about as closely as we can possibly find in American jurisprudence. And yet, they're trying to make the argument that they can't do it. The law just doesn't work that way, and it doesn't work that way in this particular instance.
Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, he spoke with International Edition's Lori London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The White House announces a venue for the summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore. The Ecuador's foreign minister has elected the next president of the UN General Assembly. She's the fourth woman to lead the General Assembly. President Trump wants separate trade talks with Canada and Mexico. And Iran is planning to boost uranium enrichment capacity after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Have you ever wanted some way to tell whether meat and other food products are safe to consume? A research group of mechanical and chemical engineers, as well as biochemists at Canada's McMaster University, may have come up with such a solution. They've developed a new transparent test patch that can tell you if food you're about to buy or eat has become contaminated. Detailing their new product in the American Chemical Society journal, Nano, the researchers suggest their patch can be put directly into food product packages. The patch will look out for harmful microorganisms like E. coli and Salmonella that may have developed in the food. The researchers say their patch could replace the best before date currently marked on various foods and drinks and provide a definitive answer whether you should toss or not buy food products like meat or milk. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the United Nations criticizes the U.S. policy of separating immigrant children from families. Dozens of people died when a volcano in Guatemala suddenly erupted Sunday, giving people too little time to escape plumes of ash. President Jimmy Morales has declared 3 days of national mourning. One planetary geosciences professor said the 3,763-meter-tall Fuego volcano spewed a pyroclastic surge impossible to outrun. David Rothery of Britain's Open University in Milton Keynes, northwest of London, spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty.
The volcano erupted explosively. Expanding gas destroyed the magma from the top of a magma conduit at the top of the volcano and threw it out as a mass of tiny rock fragments that we call volcanic ash. Now, very often, this hot ash and gas will rise in the air and form an ash column. This time it was too dense and it cascaded down the side of the mountain. And this stuff goes at over 100 kilometers an hour, and at the base of it is very hot. And you don't want to be caught in that. You're dead. It's so hot it sweeps past you. You die. And then when it's gone, there's only a fine sprinkling of ash left. So it's very easy to see the bodies. So this is what happened. It was fast-moving pyroclastic flows, and people don't seem to have been aware of the hazard.
And, of course, people live close to or on the mountain.
Yes. I mean, the people that died, I understand, were working in the fields. With a volcano in a state of unrest, Indonesia tends to evacuate people. I believe there's still an evacuation order around Agung, a volcano on Bali, which entered a state of unrest last September. At the peak of evacuation, they moved 100,000 people away for fear of pyroclastic flows. Now, Fuego has been in a state of unrest for more than 15 years, and particularly the past month. But the local civil defense people seem not to have evacuated anybody. Now, with hindsight, that was a mistake. But whether they had the information beforehand to make a proper judgment of that, I don't know. If people had been aware of the hazard and had left the area beforehand, then they wouldn't have died.
It certainly points up the unpredictability of these volcanoes.
Yes, when the volcano was observed to be in a state of heightened activity, and it has produced pyroclastic flows before. I think the ones we've just had were particularly vigorous and far-traveling, but I don't think they were totally unprecedented. So I think when the buses all died down. There may be some lessons to be learned from this, but evacuating people is difficult to do for all kinds of cultural issues in societies. People don't like men with guns coming in saying, leave your farm. What are they going to do? They're subsistence farmers, some of them. And it's very difficult evacuating people for months on end when nothing happens. It's a no-win situation for the authorities in situations like this.
David Rothery of Britain's Open University. Authorities have had the difficult task of identifying the dead, many of whom are unrecognizable. While the eruption appears to have subsided, the newly deposited ash creates a separate hazard. When rain falls, it will turn into a wet concrete-type slurry that can destroy bridges. The UN Human Rights Office is criticizing the United States' new zero-tolerance policy aimed at deterring migrants and refugees from coming to the United States. Under this policy, people caught entering the country irregularly are subject to criminal prosecution, and their children, some very young, are taken away. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the agency's headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office calls this separation of family arbitrary and a serious violation of a child's rights. The United States is the only country that has not ratified the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. Nevertheless, the agency says this does not absolve the U.S. from the responsibilities to adhere to and protect these rights. Human rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says the use of immigration detention and family separation as a deterrent runs counter to human rights standards and principles. She says children should never be detained because of their or their parents' immigration status. She tells VOA there's no justification for detaining children.
Detention is never in the best interest of the child, and always constitutes a child rights violation. Entering a country without the relevant papers should not be a criminal offense. At most, it should be an administrative offense, so these people should not be detained. Detention is never in the best interests of the child, and these children are effectively detained. They are separated and detained.
The UN Refugee Agency also condemns the Trump administration's immigration policy. It says preserving family unity is a fundamental tenet of refugee protection. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler tells VOA the unity of the family is sacrosanct and should be preserved in the best interests of children and society as a whole. He says detention should be a measure of last resort.
Most of the people attempting to enter the United States across the southern border are coming from three Central American countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, which are experiencing high levels of violence and persecution, often targeting children and young people, and forcing families to flee to protect their lives.
Spindler says people fleeing countries of violence should be given international protection. He says the right to claim asylum is a fundamental human right. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the zero-tolerance policy several weeks ago. Sessions said Congress has failed to pass legislation to fix the problem. The issue has sparked a political debate in the U.S. ahead of midterm congressional elections later this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
5,500 kilometers of open water lie before Ben LeCompte as he attempts to swim across the entire Pacific Ocean. The journey for science begins today. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Never again, he said, after swimming the Atlantic Ocean in 1998. But 51-year-old Ben LeCompte will be spending 8 hours a day for the next 6 months swimming the Pacific Ocean.
I think I like to push the limit, my personal limit, and try to find what that is, and also to respect the environment.
A sailboat carrying food, supplies, and research gear will follow him. His journey from Japan to California will take him through the Pacific Garbage Patch, an area three times the size of France where plastic pollution accumulates and threatens wildlife.
When I was little and I was with my father walking on the beach, I didn't see any plastic or very hardly. And now every time I go with my kids, we see plastic everywhere. So it made me think, wow, all that happened in just 30, 40 years, so how it's going to be in the future? What is it going to be for my kids?
LeCompte will collect samples for researchers to study how plastic pollution affects life in the ocean and on land. Data for dozens of experiments will be gathered along the way, studying radiation from Fukushima, ocean chemistry and biology, and the effects of this extreme crossing on the swimmer's body and mind.
My body is just in autopilot, and everything that happened to my body, pain or being cold and all that, I try to put it aside. I try to think about my body just being a vehicle for me to do things.
A human vehicle burning 8,000 calories a day with nothing but a wetsuit and goggles between him and the boundless Pacific. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. 50 years ago today, Senator Robert Kennedy was fatally shot in Los Angeles while campaigning for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. presidency. He died the next day. Kennedy had just won the California Democratic primary, where he defeated Senator Eugene McCarthy. Kennedy had been his brother John's presidential campaign manager and attorney general. Earlier in his career, he had worked for controversial Senator Joseph McCarthy. After his brother's assassination, Kennedy won a U.S. Senate seat in New York. Larry Tye is the author of the 2016 book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. He tells me how he believes Kennedy underwent a transition from a reputedly ruthless politician to a man who reached out to those marginalized by society.
The transformation from the bad Bobby to the good Bobby was a process that lasted for his full 20 years of his professional life. And what happened was, as he saw more of the world, as he experienced issues, whether they were civil rights or poverty, he learned and he grew in a way that we're not used to seeing politicians do. And so while he started out life relatively narrow-minded, a total believer in the table-thumping, red-hunting Senator Joseph McCarthy, over the years, he was changing. And if there was a single epiphany moment during that change, it was his brother Jack's death in 1963, which really taught him more than anything how to see life from the perspective of the underdog. He started actually reading Greek tragedies given to him by his sister-in-law, Jackie Kennedy. He saw that the Kennedy story was the story of the ancient Greeks who looked like they had everything and then could watch it all crash around them. And he decided that he had to rebuild his life, and he did it in a way that made him increasingly empathetic.
I remember I was 11 years old when he announced his candidacy for president, and it was a very, really short candidacy, really only 2.5 months. Had he been expected to announce that he would challenge was then President Lyndon Johnson, and as well as another candidate, Senator Eugene McCarthy, who was running a very popular campaign?
No, he initially said no. All the anti-war people went to Bobby, wanted him to be their candidate. He repeatedly said no to him. They went to their third or fourth choice, Gene McCarthy. He said yes. And yet, over time, Bobby felt increasingly guilty. He realized, on the one hand, that it would be traumatic to challenge a sitting Democratic president, and especially the guy that his brother, Jack, had picked as his vice president. And yet, with Vietnam and with everything else, with Lyndon Johnson, Bobby thought that he just wasn't delivering. And he felt this extraordinary guilt about not running. And so while he looked ruthless in deciding to run announcing that he was going to run about 15 minutes after Gene McCarthy had showed in the New Hampshire primary how vulnerable LBJ was. The truth was that a full 9 days before New Hampshire, Bobby had told his brother and he had told a bunch of reporters that he was going to jump in. He wanted to give McCarthy a fair shot at LBJ in New Hampshire because McCarthy had been running for so long. But when Bobby finally came in, he had the most cynical reporters in America who thought at the time that he was ruthless. One of them wrote a telegram to Ted Kennedy saying, "Your brother's entry into this presidential race shows that St. Patrick didn't drive all the snakes out of Ireland." And that was the attitude of the press at the beginning. By the end, reporters had fallen in love with Bobby to the point where they were going to their editors and asking to be taken off the campaign because they could no longer be objective.
Wow, that I did not know. Looking back at the life of Robert Kennedy, what do you think is his legacy?
His legacy, and a legacy that is especially resonant in today's world, is that it really is possible to build bridges between whites and blacks, between young and old, between poor and rich, in a way that in a divisive time like today in America, we've despaired on. And the way you do that, more than anything, Bobby Kennedy taught us, was to tell the truth. He would go into black communities in 1968 at a time of riots in the cities, and he would tell African Americans, "We need, number one, safe streets, and we can't talk about anything else until we get safe streets." He would go into white communities and say exactly the opposite. "We need, number one, racial justice, and we'll never get safe streets until we get racial justice." It was the opposite of a demagogue. It was telling people what they didn't want to hear, and shockingly, people bought it. And I think today, similarly, if a politician were to shock us by telling us the truth, we might actually believe them.
Author Larry Tye speaking to me from Massachusetts. That's our show. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 17, 2014, a Malaysia Airlines passenger airplane, designated as Flight MH17, left Amsterdam for Kuala Lumpur with 298 passengers and crew. 3 hours into its flight, the airplane was shot out of the sky over eastern Ukraine. All 298 people on board died. Most of the victims were Dutch, Malaysians, and Australians. As a direct result of Russia's aggression in Ukraine, by mid-July 2014, Ukrainian security forces and Russia-led forces had been fighting in southeastern Ukraine for over 3 months. It is worth noting that on July 14th, just 3 days before MH17 was destroyed, two Ukrainian military aircraft were shot down by the Russia-led forces using Russian Buk surface-to-air missiles. The International Civil Aviation Organization warned governments not to overfly southeastern Ukraine, but this warning did not include the region where MH17 crashed. On May 24, 2018, a Dutch-led international team of investigators announced that Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 had been shot out of the sky by pro-Russian separatists using a Buk missile that had been transported into eastern Ukraine from a Russian military unit based in western Russia. The Buk missile was fired from Russia-controlled territory in eastern Ukraine. Because Russia provided the weapon, the Netherlands and Australia are seeking to hold Russia accountable for the tragedy. Despite these facts, Russia continues to deny its involvement. We strongly support the decisions by the Netherlands and Australia to call Russia to account for its role in the July 2014 downing of Malaysia Flight No. 17 over eastern Ukraine and the horrific deaths of 298 civilians. It is time for Russia to acknowledge its role in the shooting down of MH17 and to cease its callous disinformation campaign, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert in a written statement. As the findings of the joint investigative team made clear, the Buk missile launcher used to bring down the passenger aircraft is owned by the Russian Federation and was assigned to the Russian 53rd Anti-Aircraft Brigade near Kursk. It was brought into sovereign Ukrainian territory from Russia, was fired from territory controlled by Russia and Russian-led forces in eastern Ukraine,